This episode of Fear the Boot contains unusually coarse language and subject matter, particularly in the first few minutes. I would normally have edited it out, but I lost a bet on something, and so it's going to stay in. If you're listening to this at work or around small children, or if you yourself are sensitive to these sorts of things, then please use discretion in listening to this episode. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy the show. It's Thursday, July 9th, 2009. And you're listening to episode 155 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 1 minute. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name's John.
My name is Pat.
My name, it's Chris.
Dan, was that acceptable for you? Every once in a while, you seem to bitch about the order that we all say, hey, my name is.
Whatever. I don't care, as long as you get it out like one at a time. I mean, I'm not real picky.
I think you are very picky.
I think he's picky. I think he's nose picky.
Well,
you know what?
Chicken butt.
He is a little chicken butt. You legs and thighs.
He thought he had a booger, but it was snot.
That was so lame.
Back when I was in grade school. Speaking of that, Pat, the common saying was to you think you're hot snot on a silver platter, but you're really a cold booger on a paper plate.
Nice.
Wow. Was that
in
1932?
That was close. 33.
I taught the booger, but it's snot thing to my son. And he actually does it. 2.5-year-old.
All right, let's get down to something.
It's about my level of humor.
Pat, yeah. Shut up.
No, you started this. You brought this on yourself.
I relish this, actually, Pat, serving you, Dan. I love it. After a couple weeks ago, it was just great.
Power 16-2.
Oh, my God, the fate of the universe.
Dun, 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 dun.
Done. This week.
Do you know that some people have accused me of sounding fake? When I'm pimping this Power 16, they're accusing me of being like, oh, you don't really mean it. You're just trying to sound fake. It's the fate of the f-ing universe, people. The role-playing game universe. And it's like, oh, you're fake. No, you're fake.
Don't say dildo.
I would never doubt your enthusiasm, Chad.
I cannot believe you beeped out dildo, Dan. That is
you son of a bitch.
That is a town in Newfoundland.
It's true. Have you seen a dildo yard sale?
Yes, a dildo yard sale.
Giant dildo yard sale.
Newfoundland, dildo Newfoundland is a real place.
Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go out and look up dildo Newfoundland.
Do it. And put it in the show notes.
You can do? If it's a real town,
you could just go to the forums and see the frickin' road sign for it.
Yeah, the road sign's right there.
Yes. Yes.
That's all the proof you need.
And I wasn't talking about some masturbatory aid, you sick fuck. It was dildo Newfoundland that I was referring to. And the fine people of Newfoundland.
If I can find dildo Newfoundland, I will not piss out of this episode.
Excellent.
All right. So you know, its sister city is right down here in the boot heel, Cooter, Missouri.
That's right.
Yep.
That city I am familiar with. Been there many times. All right. So Power 16-2. This week, we are in the finals for the Denny's League. All right. Past week, we had the finals for the Shadowrun League, which since we're recording a week in advance, I have no idea how that turned out. But we are in the finals now for the Denny's League, which is the last battle before the final battle, the battle That's between right. the Shadowrun League and the Denny's League.
I'm very excited to hear this.
If you want to see the pictures that are still being drawn, you can find it in the Bracketology thread, which I'll link from the show notes. And incidentally, Skolossus, the guy that draws the pictures, also has a webcomic, which you can find at theprincessplanet.com. I'll link that in the show notes. Pretty funny.
Yeah, it's a funny comic. I enjoy it.
So yeah, if you enjoy his art and enjoy his style of humor, be sure to check out theprincessplanet.com.
Mm-hmm. And even if you don't enjoy his art and his style of humor and have no idea who we're talking about, check out
Dildo Newfoundland.
Dildo Newfoundland.
All right, Power 16-2, I'll let you guys guess. There's some surprises in this one.
What were the matches?
All right, let's start off with Batman versus Capital Ships.
Oh.
I'm picking Capital Ships.
I'm picking Batman because I hate the fact that Capital Ships are... Oh, you're smiling. They lost. Damn it.
Capital Ships won, but I picked Batman.
Did they win?
I picked Batman.
Yes.
45-55, Capital Ships beat Batman.
yeah.
It's a load of horse crap.
No kidding. They're so boring.
I love you guys. All of our millions and millions of listeners, I love you each individually as my own children, wives.
Uh-huh.
And bisexual lovers.
No yeah. What, is this going to mean battle, you know, cap ship article 57 or
actually,
something?
There's another one I'm working on. Next one.
I quiver in anticipation.
Julie Hussey versus the plot wagon.
Julie Hussey.
I'm totally picking my wife. Kills her. Not only because she's hot, but because she's hot.
I'm totally picking Chris's wife because she's totally hot and she gave me like sweet, sweet desserts. Take that how you please.
Is anyone taking plot wagon?
No.
No? Oh. You were wise not to do so. Julie Hussey, 73-27.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome.
Shatters the plot wagon.
She stomped that thing like she stomps my balls.
Wow. Yeah,
I'd pay good money for that too.
I gotta write that down here. Holy
plot
crap.
Wagon is being driven by Michael Dukakis and Barry Goldwater.
I have a clarification here. It's a really minor one, but for our Gen Con stuff, we'll pimp that in more detail in later episodes. Since we did it last episode, I won't repeat it. But if you've not signed up yet for that list, go to feartheboot.com, look for the Gen Con link, get signed up for all of our Gen Con stuff.
From my understanding, there is over 30 people, non-hosts and non-people who are participating.
That's an outdated number, though. I don't know what it is as of this week.
Last I heard, there's probably more now.
Yeah, because that's
at least 30 people. And there are at least half a dozen games planned.
Because as of this episode dropping, that number will be about 17 days old.
A certain person by the name of Chris Hussey has accepted my Succession Wars challenge.
I don't know this individual.
I know.
I have a clarification. It's a simple one. I mentioned I was going to run a Star Trek ship-on-ship game, and there seems to be some confusion about what game it is I'm running. For those of you that are familiar with Starfleet Battles, the Task Force game that requires a PhD in the game to play the game.
And like 17 pencils?
That's not what I'm running. I am running the older FASA version.
Yeah, the new one sucks.
It's actually has some RP to it, and it is relatively rules light. Each of you will get a separate worksheet that represents your console on the bridge. It is very easy to play. If you can do simple addition and subtraction, you can play this. It is not the Task Force
version. I have to say that if anybody out there has been listening to this podcast knows that I am not the rules guy, I'm not the math guy, and in junior high, I played this and enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, it is a...
It is wonderful. And not... I'll have to kind of down you for a minute here, Dan, but I don't mean to.
That's fine. I'll shank you.
It's not how Dan runs it either. I mean, although Dan is a very good GM... The rules are really cool. It's a very cool system and how they have it set up. And then Dan did make some house rules on it, and it's a lot of fun. It should be awesome.
Changing gears completely, Chad, you have somebody to congratulate.
You know who I love, Chris? Who I really respect?
Besides me, who do you love?
I really respect Edward R. Murrow. Did you know that?
somebody gave me a present. Why do you respect Edward R. Murrow?
I respect Edward R. Murrow because there is an award, a national award for broadcasters that is awarded every year for excellence in, let me read this, the Radio and Television News Directors Association gives out the Edward R. Murrow's Award to honor electronic journalism since 1971.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, I bet you have because you won one.
I did win one, yes.
You won one recently, and I'm just going to read the piece. It's not very long, so please don't fast forward through this. But
okay.
The piece called Rising Waters was part of the DVD and book project called Unnatural Disasters. It includes interviews with KWWL news staff, which is the place that Chris works, and video that was aired on KWWL TV during the flood. Marketing producer Phil Hunt edited the documentary, while marketing director Chris Hussey was the executive producer. So you won an international national award in journalism, named after Edward R. Murrow, who's just a really great guy.
I did.
So Chris, congratulations, man. That is awesome.
It's no Robin D. Laws Award.
Nor is it an Emmy. But
no, of course not.
No, it is actually the documentary won a regional because they have regional and then the regional winners go on the national competition and we have won the regional award for that back in April and then I found out several days ago or a couple weeks ago by the time this episode drops, that we won the National Award. So I'll be heading out to New York City in October to go and receive the award. Absolutely. This is, yeah, it is. It's very humbling, to be quite honest with you.
Let me give you a heartfelt congratulations on that. That is awesome.
That is awesome. Yes. Congratulations, Chris. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Pat, you've never seen a Robin D. Laws Award before,
I have,
right? This is going to be a total Rorschach test, all right?
Okay.
At a glance, you tell me.
Oh, my God, it's totally a glance.
Oh, my
That's
God.
Awesome.
It even has the little drapes hanging off
it
to
does.
The sides at the bottom.
I'm pretty sure it's got the Grand Kleagle patch on it as well.
As those of you who have been following us for a while know, at ICON 2008, we were awarded the Robin D. Laws Award for Innovation Excellent in Gaming. And we're flattered, and I'm not making fun of the award, because we're flattered, because Robin Laws has contributed a great deal to the industry. And on top of that, we are the second recipient of the award. The only person to receive it before us is, well, the...
Of course, Robin D.
Laws,
yeah.
himself, the, you know, the great guy, fellow.
Yeah.
But the image that is on this plaque is a rocket ship taking off in front of a planet and a moon. But at a glance, that rocket ship looks like a Ku Klux Klan hood. And I just...
Wow.
Yeah, close up, it looks exactly like what it's supposed
no,
to.
No, even close up, I can kind of see that.
All right.
That's
hey,
crazy.
Can I, just going back to my award for a minute, I don't know if I'm going to get an acceptance speech, but John, can I steal the one that you used?
You totally can.
Awesome.
You tell them you got into broadcast journalism to nail Edward R. Murrow, and then you found out he was a guy.
I found out he was a dude, but then I was still okay with that.
Yes.
Chad?
Yes?
You wanted to brawl.
Uh-oh.
In the spirit of capital ships.
Yes.
I will let you decide who's going to take the first volley here, you or me.
Uh-oh. I'll take the first volley.
All right, fire.
So, I've known Dan for a long time.
Get ready, folks. This is going to be a wide miss here.
Yeah, yeah.
Are we talking about capital ships or cantrips?
Oh, cantrips.
Okay.
So, Dan has this personal RPG pride, and I don't know if any of you guys out there have, like, this, I do X in RPGs really, really well, and I can really take on this really well. I can do rules, or I can do RPR, I can do the... Dan's claim to fame with RPGs, and one that he tells at parties, I've heard you tell this story at parties, is how you can wreck any role-playing game mm-hmm. with cantrips.
All right.
And now, you've recently changed your tune. You've recently said, oh, I don't mean cantrips, I mean utility spells. He's like, I can play a magic user that has the most BS spells in the player's handbook that do absolutely nothing. And I could rules lawyer there, twist them, and because I'm really good at debate and stuff, and argument and logic, because I've taken all these classes and I've done all this practice with it and stuff, I can argue down any GM on the face of the planet into getting any will that I want out of using cantrips. I could pop the eyeballs out of a dragon. I could change a king's mind with cantrips. This is your claim to fame. Screw Fear the Boot. Screw writing. Screw any of this stuff. All the community outreach, all the charity you've done. Your claim to fame is cantrips.
My tactical officers tell me my fleet has sustained only minor damage, and most of these shots went very wide of their intended targets.
Right.
For starters...
You know what they say about military intelligence, though, don't you?
I said my tactical officer, not military intel. If you're in the military, I apologize to you that Chad is completely insensitive to the sacrifice you make for this country.
Uh-huh.
You may send him your hate mail to Chad at
FearTheBoot.com. That's right.
I'll be giving money to the USO.
I think I just
Whereas
got
I'll be giving
eye.
Money to the Communist Party.
That's right.
Apparently.
I think I just got shot in the eye by one of your overshots.
Yeah.
So, for starters, I only said cantrip because cantrip was just a colloquial description.
So you were able to twist
spells.
That broad, unpainted meaning to do whatever you wanted it to do.
Well, it'd be like talking about attack spells. And so you had these utility spells that we also called parlor spells or cantrips that had more of a utility than they do this much damage or provide this much armor. They do other stuff. They freeze the floor. They change somebody's mind. They turn stone into mud. You know, they did these very qualitative rather than quantitative things. And what I have not just claimed, but I have successively done in game after game after game, is gotten myself out of very sticky situations where we are horribly and hideously outgunned, not by rules lawyering.
You do know in a role-playing game that those situations where you're horribly hideous outgunned with no hope to survive because you're the PCs, it's actually engineered to where you survive, right?
Not always, no.
And yeah, it pretty much is.
Through my creativity and creative application.
Man, can you see Dan like sitting in one of those romance movies where they're chasing the plane thinking, oh, damn it, it's lost. I gotta go home now. I'm so sad.
Yeah, I'm gonna go into the other room with a shotgun. In the
I did come to that.
So, through the creative application of these spells.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry that it's you great. Have so little creativity that the best you can do is mock my Mensa level application of Dancing Lights.
Did you say Mensa's level of application?
You might as well have, Chris.
And make yourself feel better.
How you doing, Pat?
Mm-hmm.
About great. How you doing, Chris?
Yeah.
About your deficiencies.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
So, okay, I need to bring in a proxy brother here.
Yeah, because I just annihilated your fleet.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With a decisive volley.
It sounds like you just had a string of bad DMs is really what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Who's letting you get away with all kinds of business.
I agree. John, you're the D&D expert here. What is your opinion on this? For or against Dan, I'm just bringing you in on this one.
Thinks he's a lot more clever than he thinks he is. I don't know how he's
You've never sat in these games.
Dude.
You have no frame of reference.
5-foot gust of wind knocking the dragon off the cliff aside. Pray tell me how you beat the game with sticks to snakes. Or, I don't know, prestidigitation.
Prestidigitation, I can't give you one on. But sticks...
Well, okay. I tell you what. Give us a real world example.
Okay.
Of a cantrip.
Not of a cantrip. Once again, utility spell.
Uh-huh.
Not a cantrip.
See, in this past year, he has changed his story.
No,
okay. Cantrip, a spell that does absolutely no damage and has a negligible
You're in an underground
result.
Cave. You stone shape to encase the head of a bodak. You have nothing but a massive XP victim waiting to be killed. There's a good example.
See, that screams cheesy to me.
Most people will be reaching for their...
Can't do that extensive bit.
Oh, yes, it can. Most people are reaching for their lightning bolt or fireball, but you take stone shape and you look at the square footage it allows. If you have a bodak near a stone wall,
wait,
encase its head.
Hold on.
And it is harmless.
What is a bodak?
A bodak is an extremely powerful undead that gets most of its powers through its eyes and mouth. You case its head, which only requires a few cubic feet of stone, and it's done. You could walk up to it and have your way
Don't
with it.
Don't you think that violates
XP.
The spirit
See,
of the law?
Here we go. You got to find some creed.
Did you read how long stone shape takes to effect, or did your DM just have the bodak stand there?
Let me grab a player's handbook. Let me see.
Yeah, but now who's criticizing what? Dan, are you trying to point out the flaws in the rule system? Or
no, Dan
you...
is trying to point out the flaws in the everything but Dan and how the Dan can use the utility
no,
spell.
No, I'm
to
trying
beat the
to
game.
Point out that the spells everyone thinks are useless is only because they lack creativity, that there's more to a mage than lightning bolt and fireball.
I think that in D&D, cantrips and that sort of thing are role-playing game props that are put in there just to pander to a certain kind of audience that generally doesn't play D&D to begin with.
Thinkers is what we'll call them.
No, people who want to role-play cleaning their
room. To me, cantrips
have
always been exactly as you described them, Chad. They're role-playing props and should be used as such. I've always been in love with cantrips and as the detailed written-out cantrips were in second edition. To me...
John... Stone shape, casting time, one round, duration, permanent.
So
saving throw, none. That's how long it takes to work.
Yeah, that's how broken it is.
Down that detail, what's the square footage? What can it do? Okay, show me the yurt that you can make out of the spell.
Can't you cast that spell on... except maybe a stone monster, but can't you cast that on
By means
any
of this
monster?
Spell, the wizard can form an existing piece of stone into a shape that suits his purposes. For example, a stone weapon can be made, a special trapdoor fashion, or an idol sculpted. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, see? Dan's right.
Blah, 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 blah.
My fleet carries on towards your home worlds. Anything left, gentlemen?
Yeah. You may be right, but you're still an a**hole. I wouldn't allow that in my game because that's cheesy as crap.
This friggin' thing took a 6-second round to take effect, I'd give your Bodak a pretty good chance of ducking his head 2 feet down.
No saving throw. It says it right there in the rules. No saving throw.
What are you going to save against? The stone moving?
I mean, does it even give a damage?
You're right, no saving throw. He moves out of the way. And
he had his turn.
Stone is not going to get a saving throw, but what you're trying to affect it on is going to get a saving throw. You're not casting a spell on the Bodak.
Yeah, not
casting
according to the rules.
Yeah, on the stone.
This is the exact same reason why...
Do I get to choose to simply move out of the way when he swings at me? No, because it's not my turn.
The same kind of thing was with the spell Shatter from 2nd edition was so poorly defined or whatever, so loosely defined, that they changed it into 3rd edition, because I remember playing in 2nd edition, I used it to break people's bones. I just go up to him and touch him, your bone's broken, or your skeleton shattered, because
I think this is an example of what is termed as rules lawyering. Yeah, sure, the logic follows. I don't deny that the logic follows of it, but it's really...
I do.
It's not what the rules intended. It's not what the game is. I mean, what is to keep this from casting stone spell on or stone shape on you?
Nothing.
I mean, nothing.
Exactly.
And you know what? That's not a fun game.
That's my point, though, is that if you have any amount of creativity, the spells that sound useless are the most powerful spells in the game.
But it makes for an unfun game.
I don't agree. I have to side with Dan here for the simple fact that he is talking about creativity, because most people look at these like exactly like you're describing them. The most useless freaking spells in the book.
I don't say that
Who gives a crap about them?
Yeah.
I don't want them because they're dull, they're boring.
I don't say that they're useless, but here's what I say.
They don't buff me or do damage, so they're
no. A game like D&D is a tactical game. It's a tactical game first, it's a role-playing game second.
Uh-huh.
Unlike other games... Well, we'll say what the popular, super popular indie one is that just won the Origin Award is Mouse Guard. And Mouse Guard is a role-playing game first and a tactical game second. Is that Dan is using, like, the role-playing game stuff as tactical stuff. And it just, in that context, in the D&D context, it doesn't mesh well. If you want to do damage to an enemy in D&D, the spell or the ability or whatever has to list damage, and it has to list specific damage to specific saving throws. I mean, you could say, well, I use whatever the spell is to make food, and then I fill and I magnify it, and I use this permanent spell, and I use this booster spell, and I fill the entire room up with food, and I drown the enemy in food. Yeah, that's really creative. And you know what? It's actually kind of funny, and you know, you could actually get some role-playing stuff out of it and kind of do a comedy game. I got no problem with that. That's hilarious. But really?
I can't
really
wait.
Is it kind of like, isn't that kind of more of a silly thing to do?
Chad, there's one thing that I think we are going to have to see eye to eye on here. As my victorious fleet surrounds your dying homeworld, there's one thing that our races will agree upon, which is that the forum discussion that's going to pursue on this is going to be hysterical.
It's going to be outrageous. it's going to be either outrageous or it's going to be yet another... Here is a 5,000-word response on how to screw D&D.
Yep.
You know,
I'm going to rules lawyer your rules lawyering.
And you know, the problem with D&D and like, oh, I've got this spell ability class combo that's unbeatable. You're applying a tactical situation to it. And D&D, like I said, it's a tactical game first, it's a role-playing game second, but it's not a very good tactical game. When you start looking at like what Games Workshop puts out, what Privateer Press puts out, what name any miniatures tactical game, you know, my 10 pounds of Prussian joke, it's not a very good one. There's so many rules and so many books and so many other things and add-ons to it, is that it's unbalanced. It doesn't even try and be balanced. D&D is not supposed to be balanced. It's supposed to be players win. That's it.
What's your problem? He's describing a thing where the player won by a creative means.
Yeah, but the player is supposed to not think he was winning and then have to cast a lot of magic missiles to win.
Well, that's boring to me.
Railroad. You know how actually this whole thing started way back in history.
I will tell you what my problem is with it. My problem is not the fact that he does it, because actually I've seen him do it. I'm totally pretending you're not here,
right,
by the way.
Okay.
Is that I've seen him do it in role-playing games that I've played in. Not that I've ever, actually, I thank you, because you've never done this in the game that I've ran.
Stop pointing at
him. Oh, I'm sorry. The problem is he's so damn proud of it. Is that he goes on and on. I have heard this story told to the same people multiple times of, you know, I could take any cantrip, now utility spell, and I could totally F your game up. I'm Dan Reppinger. I'm the host of Fear the Boot. I'm so awesome. And, you know, he talks so, just like that.
You're just mad. Gosh, I hope so. I hope you talk like that for the rest of your days, Dan. That is so awesome.
You're just mad because he beat your game up like it owes you money.
No.
I've never done it to
Chad. Actually, I think that I've only ran two games for him. I've ran that, the game where you play the monsters. It was way back in the day, and I had those magic users that use chalk. And they had that chalk. It just sounds really stupid. It's like chalk based attack and stuff.
You deserved it.
No. They could draw runes. Like they didn't cast spells, but they drew the spells with chalk.
So they get a comment. What are you talking about?
Let me draw on the floor. It wasn't D&D.
Let me draw on the floor.
He's talking about Nightbane / Nightsfall. Yes, that which was a really good game.
Thank you.
Palladium's best product ever. Oh. Chad ran a great game.
Thank you.
So
thank you.
Praise to you as well.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go out and buy a plated game, it is Nightspawn, Nightbane, Night, whatever it's called this week. It is definitely worth your money.
Night at the Roxbury.
I really don't care for plated games except for Night at the Roxbury and Nightbane. But you have to change one thing with Nightbane. You play a monster and you're hidden. I mean, it's kind of like this Vampire the Masquerade thing. You're hidden and it's secret and they have this sort of underground railroad type thing and underground clubs. And the perspective is in a city with 1 million people, there's 20,000 monsters, and that just pushes the realm of unbelievability. It's just silly. There's so many monsters.
Yeah.
Why don't they just come out on Larry King and say, hey, we want rights?
Yeah.
Because of the masquerade.
Yeah, there isn't really one,
yeah, which is why we just changed it so in a city of 1 million people, there's 20 monsters.
Right.
Not 20,000 monsters.
And then there's enemies and stuff.
Probably is one of the best random character creation systems I've ever seen. Yeah. I rolled a character completely randomly who was absolutely awesome to play.
Yeah. But as I was saying, just to finish my point, I have seen Dan use these cantrips, because they used to be cantrips.
That's what, categorically they were called at one point in history.
And yeah, he does use them in a cool way. And it used to be that you didn't have a consideration for the GM's game.
Right.
And you used to kind of get a sick thrill out of breaking the game, going off the ranch, going off the rails.
Yes.
And I will say, especially in this last game that we played on last Sunday, we were doing round robin GMing. It was only his second time ever running a game, because the first time he ran it was the week previous. Dan was sitting in on it. He had a chance to break the game a couple of times, and you chose not to. And you specifically did. So
this is good information for me, because like you just said,
you're running
am taking the helm again for the first time in a long time.
Because he hates
getting back behind the GM chair, and I haven't done it in a long time, so I've got a lot on my plate now, especially with this one over here.
Pat, what have you learned? This is kind of a vague question, but you haven't run a game in years and years. You're primarily a player. You're now on Fear of the Boot. You have a breath of experience now.
It makes you an authority on everything.
Well, yeah. Like, do you have any words of advice to a person who hasn't GM'd in years? Or what are you doing to prepare for it? What's your mindset going into this?
I'll tell you what I've done. And maybe that'll answer a question as to sort of what I'm considering or whatever. I spent the last week, and I took a trip, you know, we went on a trip, we went down to Springfield, so I had 3 hours in the car, both ways, so I had about 6 hours in the car.
Your wife actually helped you write the game.
Because my wife is also a role player, so we bounced ideas back and forth. I told her, in a nutshell, what our campaign is, the basics of it, and said, well, I've got to come up with something to do with the city. I had the seeds of an idea, so we just started talking, but what I've tried to do is I've come up with a story that I want to tell. What I've learned from this is to try to keep your options open, obviously. I don't want to railroad anything. I want to try not to railroad anything, you know, really just go with the flow. So I've tried to consider the basic plot points that I want to do can be sort of open-ended, or they can fall wherever or whenever you may or may not get to them. That's kind of my thought process. And also for this game, since we're just doing it two sessions, you know, each GM gets 2 weeks with the possibility of a third. But I'm hoping that this doesn't go to that. So I realized I've got to keep it brief. I got to keep it pretty simple. Don't go overboard because I don't know exactly how much I'll get done, say, this Sunday.
Right.
And then obviously whatever I don't, I have to finish up the last week. So I'm hoping that I've kept it simple enough so that I can get it done, but not so simple that it'll just run through in 1 week.
Right. Sure.
So that's basically what I've tried to do. So I've got the idea. I like the story that I come up with. I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
And actually having talked to you guys tonight, I almost wish I hadn't talked to you. But we'll see how
Dan's
it plays
just
out.
Just a pussycat.
No, I'm actually talking about his character.
Dan understands. Dan understands.
I think your character, it's going to be interesting. Now that I know about your character, it's going to be very interesting the way this plays out. If it plays out the way I think it might.
Let's give a little bit of history here, and then we'll get into today's major topic. But how this whole thing started way back when, I mean, this goes back 15 years, was we had a very immature, competitive style of role play, where it was the GM versus the player. And there was a guy in our group that used to always insist on playing the mage, and we always called him the parlor mage because we could not convince this guy to take magic missile or thing. All he would take is like hamster dance. I mean,
is this you?
No. This was Jeremy, and he would take nothing but the most worthless spells in the world, and he wouldn't use them to any effect. They were just worthless. And so some years later, I said, you know what? I bet by applying a little bit more creativity, I could play the same spellbook he did and actually be useful with it. And that's how that started. And then I went on to a game that was run by a guy named Kevin, who quite frankly was putting us in way over our head on some of these fights. And that's where I started realizing, you know what, if I use this utility spell and this utility spell and this utility spell, I could use them to creative effect to actually get us out of situations that otherwise, with just sheer lightning bolts, fireballs, and hit dice, we would not survive. And that's also why, Chad, as you said, I don't do that in our current series of games. I'm not playing the douchebag card with every single spell. It's because it's simply not necessary. You know, interestingly, the tangent talk here around this actually leads into what we're talking about.
Is it Dan's a rules lawyer? What?
No.
I'm sorry. Go on.
It's going to be capital ships sieging your home world. So, all right, everyone get out your protractors.
There's a saying that they walk up the stairs in combat boots, but they walk down the stairs in slippers.
Slippers, I know.
I don't get it. But I looked up some interesting facts about the number 154. Would you like to hear them, Chad?
I would.
John, let's. Oh, you know what? That reminds me real quick is that people have been asking what iPhone app game that John and I were playing while you guys were nerding all over each other. And that was Pocket Tanks for the iPhone. And it's by Builtwise Productions. You can actually get it for the Windows, although I think it's like $20. It's totally not worth it. But it's free for the iPhone, the light version. And it's basically a Scorched Earth knockoff.
Yeah, it's
like
it's
most people thought it was.
Trajectory tank type game like Worms or Scorched Earth.
It's 1-2 player. And it's actually one of the best iPhone games I have. I've played it with John. I've played it with Pat. I've even played it with Dawn while we're waiting to get seated at a restaurant. Yep. It's like 15 minutes of fun.
It's great.
Those things should really just be stationary pieces of artillery because you can't move them in any of these games.
You can move them in this.
In Scorched Earth, you could actually move.
You can move in Pocket Tanks. Okay. Really? But most people don't.
Never played Pocket Tanks, so I have no
You get
time.
Four moves, and it's like a one-inch move.
Yeah, well, tactically, though, it's really, that's powerful. I kept looking to see, like tonight, I kept looking to see if you'd move.
I should have moved.
Yeah, because I had zeroed in on you just 100%.
If I moved once, Pat would have to completely waste like two or three shots finding me again.
This is what you get for not studying World War One sufficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway.
I was also eating, you know, Mexican and drinking while I was doing it too.
That'll do it.
Yeah.
That your pork burrito.
I cannot be Patton and yell at Rommel and say, I read your book! I read your book!
You know,
because you're bombing his forces.
Drinking worked for Grant, though, so I don't know.
Some of those tangent conversations we had actually lead in pretty nice to today's main topic.
That scares me.
And as I mentioned several shows ago, by popular request, we're going to revisit some ideas that we kicked around way earlier in this show's run and take them on now with added experience, and in the case of Pat and Chris in particular, some fresh perspectives. And the one that we were going to talk about today is first games. The first games are brutal. Yes. As a GM, I have found that from the second game on, assuming the game's going to work at all, you have some kind of momentum. You've got a group synergy. People are into the momentum of role-playing. People have gotten into the plot. Things are going pretty well. But you've got that first game. Nobody's quite figured out how they're going to role-play their character. Nobody wants to be the first person to talk. The plot hasn't occurred yet, so there's nothing that's really hooked anybody. And so it's like this awkward junior high dance where everybody's kind of lurking around the walls waiting for somebody to make that first move.
Not me, baby. I was always on the dance floor with the ladies.
All right, well, Chris, if you always want to be on the dance floor, go ahead.
I was playing Super Metroid.
Did you have fun when you played Super Metroid?
Yeah.
Super Metroid's a good game.
What are we talking about? First games?
Yes,
we're talking about Super Metroid.
We're talking about Super Metroid. First games of Super Metroid. So, Chris,
yes,
if you're running a game, how do you make those first games work and not be a total wash? Because one of the things we've had in our group is we tend to say, and I think this is a bad thing, we'll say, that was really good for a first game. And we judge them by a separate standard because they are so difficult for the reasons I just listed, and probably more I didn't list. What are some of the things that you do, Chris, to help make that first game really pop and not be so different from the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth games?
You know, quite honestly, I think in general it would be different. I think that there's nothing that I, at least in my experience that I've done, where the second, third, and fourth sessions have been similar to the first. Really, in the first session, my primary goal is just to make sure everybody has fun. And that's regardless of experience level. If I've got new players or if I've got veterans, I want to essentially jump right into some sort of action. It could be, but normally I have to say that I personally don't default towards role-playing action in that first session. I'll usually try and get in and get some dice rolling going just so everybody just has a good time rolling dice, kind of seeing what their characters can do. And then when that's it, maybe do a little wrap-up role play. And if necessary, perhaps drop some plot hooks, drop a few clues here and there to kind of set things up for later. My main goal whenever I sit down for that first session is let's just have fun. Let's just go and let's just have fun. Let's not worry about how deep our characters are. Let's not worry about what's really going on with this, you know, guy who's supposedly an agent from the king. Let's just go and let's just go fight something. Let's just go get into some dice rolling mischief, and then let's be done and let's worry about that stuff on the next session and start building from there.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is that you almost intentionally shy away from the role playing in favor of more mechanical stuff like killing goblins as a way of getting people comfortable. Is that correct?
To a certain sense, and maybe also to try and build a little party cohesion. I look at it almost like a Raiders of the Lost Ark game. That first action sequence that he goes through really has nothing to do, pretty much, with the entire rest of the movie. Raiders of the Lost Ark, the only thing that beginning action sequence had to do with the rest of the movie was that Belloc, the main villain, was there. Other than that, nothing. Had nothing to do with the rest of the movie. But it sure was exciting, and it sure got you into what you were doing, and committed you to sitting down and watching the rest of that movie. You were in it for the long haul until that movie was done. And that's kind of the approach I take as well.
I'm going to brutalize the pronunciation of this, but by what you're just saying, is it also typical that you start your games, was it in res media or whatever?
In media res, I believe.
In media res. Okay, I said I was going to brutalize it, and I did.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess
I mean, love in media res.
I'm going to reveal some of my shallowness and say I don't really look at it that deeply. I will put in bits and pieces of things that may matter down the line. But for the most part, no, I'm just in the beginning, you know, like I said, regardless of experience level, I'm there to have fun. And, you know, especially if it's a bunch of newbies, I'm there to teach mechanics as well as let them have fun, because I know they're going to be rolling dice constantly throughout the entire thing here. So let's get them familiar with some of the basic mechanics of how this particular game works. And then we'll worry about all the stuff that really doesn't involve dice rolling later on, which to me can be a lot more enjoyable than the dice rolling.
You know what's funny? is I take the exactly reverse tact, and I'll explain that here in a second, but as I'm listening to you, your approach makes perfect sense. I can't say at all that it's wrong. I think it may not work in the group that I play in simply because the people that I play with are so deeply into the drama over the strategy of the game. But I had actually never considered doing it that way of simply saying, okay, I'm just going to accept that everyone's awkwardly standing along the wall and the role playing is going to be rough. So we're just not going to do it. I'm just going to get you guys swinging swords or shooting guns and rolling dice, and we'll let the role playing follow, which actually in truth is probably the simpler solution. Instead, I have devoted my mental energy to cracking the nut of how do I get people role playing right off the bat. But it's interesting to hear you describe that because, like I said, as I listen to it, your way actually makes a lot of sense.
It does. And your approach, and I'm going to say cracking that nut because I like saying cracking the nut, also makes sense because you do want your players to invest something into their characters. And so it is critical that as early as possible, and even in within that first session, you've still got to provide them with opportunities to do something with their character, to at least scratch the surface of that character's personality so they can find out exactly, or at least get an inkling or a compass direction as to where this character might be going or what this character likes to do.
I want to throw here something that we've done in our group in the last couple of games, at least. We sort of sat down, even in the character generation, and tried to skirt this issue by basically coming up with backstories that put our characters together in some way, shape, or form. So even before we start the first session, we sort of got like a backstory that describes why we're together, so to speak. Because I agree with you. I think there's nothing worse than that first session of, you know, how do you start this besides you all happen to meet in the tavern or, you know, the old cliched things. And I do kind of wonder why does everybody get so hung up on that, that has to be the classic way to start. And like, why not say, do like what Chris is saying, you've got just sort of, you start in the middle. You just assume, you know what, this is the group we're playing with. These are your characters. We'll just say they've been together for a little bit of time. Yeah. They already work together. Let's just start going. Hit the ground running.
Absolutely.
But it's so hard to do. I get hung up on that all the time.
I don't. That's what, because I absolutely hate about first games is the, oh, I don't know. Do I trust this guy? I better role play. I'm all about role playing, but the whole role playing of, do I know you? Do I trust you? I'm in a world where I don't trust people. Boring. It's boring. It's the same conversation every time, no matter if you're playing in the future or if you're playing in a fantasy game or if you're playing present day. Why are player characters so paranoid?
I know.
Why are they so untrusting?
Well, and that's what I was going to offer.
People whose job is professional adventuring, which in my opinion is either rabble-rousing or grave-robbing, why are they so paranoid?
Because they're grave-robbers.
Professional rabble-rousers.
You keep watch.
They're paranoid if they're veteran players, and they're paranoid because they've spent too long at the table and they've encountered those situations where they've been betrayed by another player or another PC, or they encounter NPCs which end up trying to screw them over. And so as a player, as a person, they subconsciously develop that level of mistrust.
Well, and I cannot stress enough. I came up with, there are four steps I take that I found help me. Taking an approach that's completely opposite to Chris's.
Booze. Number one.
No.
Everybody gets
that's
drunk.
That's step zero. That's just a presumption.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like saying we're playing a role-playing game. Yeah. I don't have to give that a step one.
You do all a right. circle reach around with everyone involved.
That's also
ooh,
that's
hey,
a
there we go.
That well, that's actually a
I
post-game.
Think I'm getting out of role-playing.
All right. So step one, and we are definitely going to have to do an episode recovering this topic as well. Because as I've said before, in the far future, when they are unearthing Fear the Boot in an archaeological dig, the one thing that I hope we can leave behind in the role-playing world,
we've junked the shark so many times,
is the group template. And that's the first biggest thing. Because one of the things we have on the group
that we follow every time, right?
Well, on our successful games, we do.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the group template asks is, what experiences have your characters already shared? And the great thing about that is not just that it gives you a common history, But that as the players, because the GM doesn't do this, as the players are sitting there developing that common history, they've already started role-playing. Because they're like, well, wait a minute, my character would be fighting this guy. And you're like, you know what? My character would be
here. I am that guy.
Yeah, I am that guy. Or I would be here for this reason. And they start kind of pseudo role-playing. And so they already start breaking that ice and breaking that tension. So on top of making characters that you know will gel, that already know each other, that already trust each other, that don't have to meet for the first time in the tavern, you've already started pseudo role-playing. And so you're already off the wall, kind of dancing at least a little bit awkwardly at arm's length to some Skid Row song.
Oh my gosh, were you at my wedding?
Wow.
I say that because I'm mistakenly, we had I Remember You as our wedding dance song. I'm not kidding you.
You know, you want to talk about the top of nerdery. Carl and I's wedding song, like our song, is Melodies of Life, which is the theme song from Final Fantasy IX.
No.
Oh my gosh. I suddenly feel so much better.
Chris, you take back that title for being the Battletech love letter guy. Dan is a bigger dork.
No. See, I got married in the morning.
You got married.
Had lunch in the afternoon and played Battletech in the evening with my new wife.
Dude, I was sitting there.
And I played it with... We got married on our gaming day.
Reception hall, something like 200
reception
guests.
Reception hall.
And we're dancing.
It cost me $50 and I got married in blue jeans and a t-shirt.
And we're dancing to Melodies of Life.
Chad, you may be a hardcore gamer, but Dan is a 15-year-old Korean boy. And for that, I think he wins.
The second thing after the group template that I found at least helps me, I am normally completely against scripting a game, railroading, all that crap, but I typically script the first little bit of the game just because I accept that it's hard to get people to talk. But if I have a script of some really boisterous NPC is going to come over and he's going to say this and do this, and I may even pick out just one person, because if you look at a group of people and say somebody roleplay, they all look at each other. But if you look at one person and say, John, the priest of such and such comes over to you and says this, you have to role play.
Yep.
And then as they're walking along, suddenly I say, Chad, you encounter John and this priest, and the priest grabs you and says this. And so I will script almost verbatim that first couple minutes of the game just to get the ball rolling.
Oh my god, you're such a tyrant GM and you totally railroad the characters and take all the control from them, and that's the only thing a character has is their own control of their character. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
That's good. That's a good tactic.
I think you'll agree with this.
Hold on, Dan, I want to jump back to your first point because I have one question I want to ask you about that.
Okay.
And I guess the question is, I want to understand the why of you do that. What the motivation for taking that time out to, in a certain sense, fill out the group template? And give me an idea of roughly how long that would take. I mean, are you talking about consuming most of the first session with filling out this form before you actually sit down to play? And I ask this very seriously.
I know I'm not Dan, but I personally find it, I think that the first session of gaming of a new game probably really shouldn't have any role-playing in it. It should be all about rolling up or point buying characters and then doing the group template and then everybody talking about how their characters are linked and then talking about what they want out of the game. You know, reorder this however you feel it is appropriate, but the game master talks about the game, the kind of story he wants to run. The players say that this is the kind of story they want to play in. Compromises are made, ideas are formed. And at the end of it, there should be either so little time left that there really shouldn't be enough time to run a worthwhile game, or you should be pushing the end of that session for the night. I really don't think that there should be any role playing.
That is a foreign concept to me, and I have a hard time wrapping
That's
my head around
you
that.
You do it wrong. I'm kidding.
I mean, but there are definite motivations for why I do the things the way I do, and I'm just curious to find out those for you. But Pat, you were going to say something, so go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that all depends on how you really define the first session. Like what Chad just described, I would call maybe the zero session.
Right, right.
That's what you do before you actually start. And I actually would call the first session where you basically start the game.
And yeah. I think that
it's after the characters are rolled. It's after the background stories are decided.
I think there's a lot of people
dice
out
on the
there.
Table.
I think there's a lot of people out there who also take care of a lot of this legwork in email and on forums and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, and we try to do that. We never have successfully done it.
Or on non-designated game days.
Yeah, I mean, if you guys are ready to rock on the first day, by all means, rock. But
I'm with Chad and Pat on this one, that in every single group I have played in from 1988 to today, we have always seen character creation as a separate night, that we are going to get together this week to make characters and make the group. The first session is the following week. We have almost never, with, I mean, exceptions I could count on the fingers of one hand, tried to start even so much as 10 minutes of RP the night we make characters. But, Chris, you have some more specific questions about the group template, which I'm going to dodge simply because I'm going to say that for the episode we do on the group template.
Mm. Fair enough.
But the third thing that I found helps is grab someone I know I can pull in. For example, Chad is a great person to start with because he's not bashful. And so when I write up that script of the priest is going to grab somebody or the general is going to grab somebody, I'll pick someone that I know is not going to be bashful about coming in with their character and speaking up. It's human nature. We tend to follow the patterns and trends we see around us. And so if you see two people getting excited, the wheels start turning in your mind about how you would do in that situation, what your character would do, and it gets other people moving mentally.
That's why I love the concept of in media res, where you start in the middle of action. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle of initiative, roll damage,
violent
combat.
Action.
Violent action, but it's in the middle of the story, in the middle of something, not, okay, you guys are standing in a street, you've just spawned.
Hmm. Yeah, that is the worst way to run a first game, in my opinion. Is
Boink.
You're in a you tell
you
them where
rise
you are
from the earth itself.
What do you do?
Yeah,
that in my opinion, that is a mood killer. Of you are in place X. What do you do?
You know what? I've even seen it in games that have been going on for months and years, where the game master comes in and they've had a big encounter the playing session before, and really. The players have to kind of work and get to the next cool thing or kind of get on the path of getting into it. And even then, the game master is like, this has been going on for years. And it's like, okay, you're standing on the streets of the city. You've just killed the dragon. You have all the loot. You've saved the princess. You've exited the castle after the congratulations of the king, and the entire city loves you. What do you do?
It's
I
horrible.
Go to Disneyland
because as a
I go to the inn and find some whores. I mean,
as a
oh,
player,
I like that better. Okay, never mind.
You have this kind of
how about go to Disneyland and find some whores.
Hey, there you go.
I don't know why we can't have our cake and eat it too, gentlemen.
There we go. I like the way John's thinking.
All right,
now.
John.
John's been silent on
baby.
This one.
Assuming she's in human form, I'd pick Ariel. Who's your pick?
Ooh.
Are you going to go with Belle? You
I know,
go
I'll just
with...
take Ariel in fish form.
But the totally wrong side is the Oh, wait.
No, not really.
The two things that matter are there, so...
That's a good question, though. I don't know.
If you had a mermaid, which Pocahontas. Half would you want to be fish? Which half would you want to be
Well,
human?
No. Would it be Ariel? Would it be, what's her name from Aladdin? Would it be...
Ooh, yeah, that's good. Jasmine.
Yeah, Jasmine.
Pocahontas, wasn't that one of them, I think?
Pocahontas, yeah. Oh, there's a large selection here.
That's true.
I like strong, independent woman. I'd like... what's the Chinese one they did?
Mulan.
Mulan, yeah. Although she doesn't
apparently you like strong, independent Asian
Donny
women.
Donny Osmond ruled in that movie, by the way.
Chris?
Yes, what?
You just made a statement I don't think you intended to.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Or maybe
by the way,
did.
Also, another thing the group template does is it avoids that issue of getting everyone together. Because with the group template, and I don't want to get into this too much, because as I said, we'll say it's through the group template episode, but it helps you already determine how these people know each other and why they're working together. So you don't have to deal with the crap of you walk into a tavern, there's a mage sitting there that you feel compelled to talk to for no particular reason.
And well, he's the only mage in the place.
It's a quirk you have.
Are you going to want to talk
everyone
to the
else is
dirt
a commoner? What the hell?
Yeah. Look at this guy. He's a poop smith. Let's talk to him. He's got the interesting quest because I'm 20.
You know, you're always putting down the poop smith.
I respect the poop smith. They're good, earthy people.
Exactly.
But they don't give out the quest.
But it gets over the trust issues and the identification issues and all that garbage.
I think that we can do an entire episode on how not to start a game in a tavern.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think we've done an entire podcast on how not to start a game in a tavern. But the fourth and final step I found is make a hook I know they'll work with. For example, John, that familiar, that toad, yes. Curious and incontinent, that is comedy
Poopy
gold.
The toad.
I know I can work with. The way that actually went down since you had to step out of that game was Mike had a familiar that was curious and I think helpful or something and helpful.
Oh, yeah.
And he was trying to run like an antiquity shop or an oddity shop. And so he would leave and come back and like his crow had completely rearranged the place. So instead of things being organized by type, they'd be organized by size or something like that. And
I would have had it like start fixing the antiques.
Well, and then he'd like freak out. And at one point, he actually tried to shoot it and rolled a critical failure. So he ended up setting his place on fire and he's putting that out. And then
there's no such thing as the critical failure.
I know there isn't technically, but I love him. And so then the crow's outside trying to patch up his roof with a little nest and everything. And I can pick something that if you know your group, you know there is something you can do. With Pat, I would start off with some guy threatening a child.
Mm.
You know there's something that's going to get the attention of somebody at the table. Grab that and start with it, because the quicker you can get somebody drawn in, involved, and worked up, whether it's an angst or comedy or whatever, the better off you are.
You know, you talked about from 1988 on till the day you die, how you sat down and created characters and stuff. I have to say that with only one or two exceptions, I have always been the exact opposite. There have only been one or two times in my entire quarter century plus a gaming that I've actually sat down with a group of people and made characters. It rarely, rarely has ever happened for me.
So what do? You have make characters at home and just bring them on the first day?
Yeah, basically, the session zero, as you guys called it for us, is us on a non-gaming day when we'd be sitting around talking about other stuff and saying, yep, well, let's do this. This would be great. Okay, we're going to do this. Or, like you said, communicate via email. And then everybody makes their characters and brings them to the session. GM checks them over. And then we kind of, you know, just got into things.
I think that's just sort of the groups that I've played with. And it sounds like the guys around the table play with. I know for us, it was somewhat laziness in the fact that I don't want to roll it up on my own at home. And also, I think for the GMs, it's just easier to check things as you're going along and doing it, as opposed to being thrown four or five characters all at once, and then you have the daunting task of making sure no one's cheated on their roll-ups or made mistakes on their signing of things.
It's the much simpler issue of you can't take four people, send them to their individual corners, and expect them to come up with a coherent group.
Well, that too.
And that for me is the bigger issue, that I found it is much better to have everyone sitting around a table so that every die roll, every equipment choice, every personality trait is done in the presence of everyone else, even if we put the cheating issue aside, which in my current group I would feel comfortable doing. It's just so that there's harmony to what is created.
I think you're right. Admonishing either approach. It just strikes me as interesting more than anything else that you have always done it this way, where I have rarely done it that way. And I think it's just an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, that's why you have kids and I don't. So, for anyone who didn't
get... just likes sex.
For anyone who didn't
dirty,
get that, I'll give
dirty
you
sex.
A week to ponder it.
I do. I so do.
Chris, I have to say, you're probably the dirtiest old man I know, and I am so looking forward to sharing
Gen Con.
I know, it's going to be great.
Yep. I've said this in past episodes. Every time I see this man, I give him the biggest bear hug I possibly can.
All right.
Because he is so wonderful.
Then I'm going to close out the show on replugging this again. Fearoftheboot.com. Check the show notes or click the Gen Con link. Get signed up.
Toft bitches want to do something for you at Gen Con.
Well, and we've got some kick-ass stuff playing.
What do we got?
Yes,
we got Succession Wars. We've got Transformers. We've got D&D.
Star
we've got
Trek.
Star Trek.
We have sushi.
Sushi.
Beer.
We've got beer. Sushi. We've got... Bully.
Some Battletech.
We've got two dirty old men.
Oh my god! I
got
to say that last year, when we had that party It was so fun. And I'm not talking the White Wolf party. That was fun, too. And all the other mixers we went to. I'm talking the Fear the Boots social at Gen Con was a frigging blast. We showed up. We didn't expect anybody to be there. Same thing with this year. We don't expect anybody to be there, but people showed up anyway, and it was hilarious. It was great.
That's all I got to say is if you're at Gen Con and you don't bother signing up for this, and afterwards you're
posting...
And by
the way, these games are free.
And totally free.
And afterwards you're posting, I really regret having missed this. All I'm going to have to say is that you are such a bitch ass that Unicron will not even eat your planet.
Wow.
I don't even want to hear it.
Gosh.
You've got no excuse. This is not like Fear the Con. You know, you can't claim I wasn't able to make St. Louis. If you're in Indianapolis, you want to be a part of this.
That's right.
So, you guys, much love. Unicron will eat your planet as of right now. He still loves you. And we will catch you next week.
Later, see ya.
Later on.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.